Live from a bunker in the heart of the Ozarks. The P stands for podcast, the I for insight, the N stands for nonsense, and the K stands for it's Sif Pop. Welcome to Sif Pop Weekly, streaming live most Fridays, or available to download later in your podcast feed, unless, of course, you're a patron.
Patrons get perks.
Patrons get those perks.
I'm a Bobby girl.
I'm your host, Aaron Dicer, and he knows that he's Knuff. It's Andrew Ormsby, ladies and gentlemen.
Ahoy!
Each week, we'll chat about movies, TV, and whatever else from the pop culture universe is on our minds. And please welcome our guest this week. We think she's the bomb. It's Alice!
Woo! Thank you, question mark?
Oh, is that not a saying there? Is that
no,
not...
it is. I just, given what we're talking about today, I don't know if I want to be affiliated with the bomb that we're discussing.
It's also a pretty aged term, right? Or does it, yeah. Is that one carried over? Like, some of them carry over. Like, cool has been around since the 50s. So, like...
Yeah. I feel like it's carried over in that people will still acknowledge and understand what it means. Because you also still say, like, when something bombs. Like...
Right.
So... It just, I don't think people use it as much in the current lexicon as maybe.
She's saying you're old, Aaron.
Yeah.
From a previous generation might have.
I still got some riz. So.
Oh my gosh. Look at him up on the slang. Andrew, do you not know what riz means?
Andrew just shaking his head. No. That's all right, man. That's all right. Can't all be as young and hip as I am.
Is it like street cred?
No, it's like attraction. Like, it's your ability to pull someone.
It's literally the
middle. Attractive.
It's literally the middle syllable of charisma, is what it is. Yeah. So, yeah.
Oh,
there you go.
And today, now you can use
on,
it.
Today on Youth Speak.
You had to say a word that's used a lot in D&D for me to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, oh, I have a really high charisma modifier. I have riz.
You got riz. There you go.
I got riz.
Oh, I'm excited. We are going to have some fun today. It is Barbenheimer weekend.
Yeah, it is.
So we are going to talk about both movies on this podcast.
Yep.
And excited to do so. Also, one of my favorite best ever challenges.
I did not expect to be as, like, I had so many.
Yeah, there are a lot in this category. I'm calling it fake first, legit last. Which basically means the movie is a name, single name, and it's either only the first name of a fake character or only the last name of a real character or real person. It's amazing how many movies fit one of those categories.
When you sent that through, I was like, there's going to be like four that I've seen. And then I started going through my IMDb and I was like, oh no, I don't have enough space. I don't know which ones I want to.
There's lots.
Geez.
And it's surprising.
The Gurus had a lot of fun with it too.
It's surprising to me. Surprising to me also that it seems like, it could be wrong, but for the most part, the movies that are named last name are usually real people, and the movies that are named first name are usually the characters. I found that really, really interesting. So it just kind of fit right into the category, fake first, legit last. Anyways, we will get there, and of course, we'll do some buried treasure as well. But let's get to the 1-2 punch that everybody's been waiting for. Let's kick it off by talking about Barbie.
When my heart breaks.
Some things have been happening that might be related.
When my world shakes.
Cold shower.
Ooh.
Falling off my roof.
Ah!
And my heels are on the ground.
Flat feet!
What do I have to do?
You have to go
to the real world.
You can go back to your regular life, or you can know the truth about the universe. The choice is now yours.
The first one, the high heel.
You have to want to know, okay? Do it again.
Barbie and Ken are having the time of their lives in the colorful and seemingly perfect world of Barbie Land. However, when they get a chance to go to the real world, they soon discover the joys and perils of living among humans. Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling are Ken and Barbie, or a Ken and a Barbie, as we find out in this movie. Many other people joining them as well. Greta Gerwig directing this one. What did you guys think? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or was just okay? Alice, we got to go to you first.
Okay, last week I felt a bit bad because I was a bit on the negative side. And last time I was on. And I cannot tell you how happy I am to come on this week, partly as well because I loved this movie. And the more I have thought about it, with the more distance I've had, the more I've loved this movie.
All right, so loved it from Alice. Andrew, like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay?
I can't commit to love, but I will say that I like this movie.
Very nice.
I had a good time with it.
You hated it. How dare you?
Yeah, you did. Yeah, you did. Because I am firmly loved it. Barbie loved it land. I think this movie is genius. And I want to talk about some of the reasons why. But Alice, I want you to start. Tell us some of the reasons why you love Barbie so much.
Well, first of all, I think Greta Gerwig is a genius. I think she's one of the best filmmakers working right now. I'm so excited every time she puts her name to something. And she's going to be doing The Chronicles of Narnia next, which I'm very excited by.
Fun.
But the main reason, I have so many positives, but the big one I want to start with is that I do think there is an element of this where, especially if you are a woman, I have never felt so seen by a film and so I can't even begin to translate the experience I had because I went to go see one of the earliest screenings. So everyone was dressed in pink. Everyone was, you know, really excited to be there. And it felt like we were all experiencing this film together because I think I want to say like 90-95% of the people in the cinema were also women. And everyone, I both scream laughed at parts of this movie and was sobbing at other parts. And I immediately wanted to go home and hug my mum. And the way that Greta Gerwig, and she's done it before. She's done it in Lady Bird. She's done it in Little Women, where she's able to translate the female experience into words in a way where I'm like, oh my God, like, yes. But it's like she's taken those speeches and elements she's put in other movies before and made an entire movie centered around this absolutely astounding aesthetic. And there are certain things that are explored, certain themes that are really looked into deeply, but at this really gloriously camp level as well, that have just made me just finally be like, yes, like, this is what I've been feeling all my life. How have you translated this, but also given me a really fun, funny movie at the same time? Like, I walked out with an existential crisis, but also with a giant smile on my face. So, yeah, that's, I don't want to take over. That's a big one.
I can bounce off that a little bit and just say, you know, Roger Ebert famously once said that movies are empathy machines. You know, they are the ability to live a story from somebody else's perspective, to literally spend some time in someone else's shoes. There is so much opportunity for empathy in this movie. And that's saying something for a movie that is kind of a straight up comedy. Like, this isn't a movie that's trying to be Little Women, right? This is a movie that is trying to make you laugh, succeeding on my part. I laughed a lot in this movie. Maybe the most I've laughed all year so far. I'd have to kind of look back and see if other movies have made me laugh this much. But there is so much empathy available here for the female experience. What does it mean to be a woman? How does that impact? I would also say there's ideas in here about masculinity that are also full of opportunities for empathy and understanding. Mm-hmm. There are opportunities here to understand how our conceptions of our own masculinity or our own femininity play into how we treat other people. Like, there's so many different ways this movie is managing to allow us to feel things we wouldn't feel on our own. Like, even as, well, for my case, as a man, watching this movie and going, okay, you know, feeling this part of masculinity that isn't necessarily something that I experience in my day-to-day life, but now I'm seeing something in it. And for a woman to be able to go, okay, maybe this isn't exactly me, but I'm finding some empathy here. I was just really, really impressed with how much of an empathy machine this movie really, really is.
Yeah, and I have to say, on that point, what I also really loved is that this movie isn't trying to solve anything. Like, I'm not to get into specifics, but there are certain themes and elements where I feel like maybe a lesser movie would have been like, and this is how we make it perfect, and this is how we... It's not about solving this ultimate element that this movie explores. It's just about acknowledging that it exists and how it affects society, and then looking at, like, just because we know it exists doesn't mean we can't start to try to maybe improve it and make it for the better. And I agree with you. I think, you know what I think it is? I think this movie is a way of personifying the ideals of feminism in the way in which it's meant to be, where it's like, just because it's called feminism doesn't mean it's about making women the number one. It's always been about equality, right? It's about gender equality. That's the whole point. Mm-hmm. And so I think this movie's trying to translate that and be like, this isn't about women being better and men being less, or flip the other way around. It's more about, like, trying to literally even the scales, no matter whether you're in the real world or in Barbie land. And exploring how, you know, even the Barbies aren't perfect either with the way that they've treated the Kens. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just loved the exploration. But yeah, the jokes, there's one in particular, and I'll say it has to do with an introduction of a new Barbie. And that is the part where I was scream laughing, because I was like, how is this enough of a universal experience for it to make it into a movie? But it's so specific to me. Like, it was just insane. Me and my friends were crying laughter, especially when there's a clip that's played. Oh my goodness. Excellent work.
Yeah. Yeah. Andrew, some thoughts?
I don't know. I hate this movie.
Yeah, clearly.
Honestly, I wanted to bounce off what you said about how this movie perfectly juggles being serious and being silly, because it does both amazingly well. So I had to give that a shout out. That was going to be my main pro for this movie. My second biggest pro for this movie, and it's something we haven't talked about yet, is a combination of set design and costumes.
Oh my gosh.
Holy crap. Especially the set design, the way they designed and built Barbie World, and they made like this huge, huge sets is incredible. It looks so crazy.
Like, as someone, because I played with Barbies, as you know, especially being a kid in the, you know, late 90s, early 2000s, like, the first 15, 20 minutes of the movie, I was just turning to my friend being like, I had that outfit. I had that. Like, there's a bit where they're at a party and they're holding glasses, like goblets or something. And I was like, I literally had those. I can't imagine. Like, I was just like, how did they replicate? And the Barbie dream house, like, I never had a dream house, but my friends did. Mm. And it's like all the different elements were, it was like they just put them in like a make big machine or something. It's just,
yeah.
Oh, insane.
Yeah. Yeah, the set design is amazing. The costuming is amazing. Hair and makeup is amazing. It's wild how detailed so much of this stuff is. Also, the performances are great.
Yes.
I think centrally Margot and Ryan are incredible in this movie. And I think the reason
for different reasons.
Yeah.
I'm going to give a similar reason. And I think they are both juggling that tone so well that we talked about, the navigating from serious to silly, that kind of thing. They both have serious moments in this movie, and I don't know that the movie's juggling of the tone works as well if they're not up to being able to make both of those things feel real. And I think that's just because they both feel like they're giving an authenticity to this make-believe character, right? And I think that that goes a long way towards allowing those more real parts to sink in. If you didn't know Ryan Gosling had comedy chops yet, first of all, where have you been? But
yeah, seriously,
you know, throw in the nice guys. You're welcome.
Stupid Love.
Oh, yeah.
Such a good movie.
La La Land, for that matter. He's hilarious in that movie.
Yeah. Also his favorite movie.
Nails the ending. But no, if you didn't know Ryan Gosling was a comedic force, well, welcome. Welcome to knowing it, because he is absolutely hilarious in this movie. Now, he's given great content to work with. The writing here is so good as well. And Margot is just killing it here. Just making me feel all the feels and laugh all the laughs, and just perfectly encapsulating what's going
on here.
She's
such a good actor. Like her, and I think it wouldn't have worked nearly as well if both her and Ryan Gosling didn't commit. Like, you can just tell that they committed. And yes, maybe what they were doing was a bit silly at times, and I can see a lesser actor maybe feeling a bit self-conscious, but they fully embrace the character and all of its eccentricities. And Margot Robbie, like, all right, she's a stunning woman, yes. So obviously her being cast as Barbie, I was like, yeah, okay. But I was watching at a certain point, I'm like, how it looks like it's just a Barbie that's come to life, because even the way that it might be the way the costumes were done, but obviously as a little girl, I looked at Barbie legs a lot, and even the way her legs are positioned and the way that they like angle, I was like, those are Barbie legs. Like what?
She's very body conscious of being a Barbie doll. Like there's times where she's like throwing herself on the ground or whatever, and she looks like somebody threw a Barbie doll on the ground.
Yes,
you know,
because like, she doesn't just like flop like a human. She does the like angle thing.
Uh-huh,
oh my God, it's so really good.
It's really good.
So good.
Yeah.
We didn't mention when we were talking about performances in comedy, I think besides Ryan, the biggest laughs my theater got was from Kate McKinnon.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Weird Barbie's amazing. Yeah.
Also, Michael Cera. Michael Cera was actually so good.
Alan
was
great. Alan. Yes.
His character's so good.
Yeah.
There, it's just everybody does. Well, I shouldn't say everybody does a good job, but I think most people in this movie do a good job.
Ooh.
And I don't mean to get into negatives, but since I'm talking about it, I think that my big negative for this movie is how much Mattel tries and puts their fingerprints all over this movie. Like having the boardroom be, you know, this character led by Will Ferrell, it felt kind of unnecessary. Like, I think that the movie could have served its purpose and given its message, which I do want to talk about more, by the way. I think it could have served its purpose and given its message without that entire group being there, because they didn't add anything to the movie. If anything, they kind of like detracted.
They're there for a statement. They are there for the ability to say, to be self-aware and say, you know, hey, we know there is, we're able to point out our own flaws, right? That's why they're there. You're completely correct. They don't play into the plot or resolution at all, especially the resolution. It just doesn't come into to play. And it also feels kind of repetitive. We've seen, you know, whatever Will Ferrell's character is in the Lego movies.
Lego movie.
Yeah. Mr. Business or whatever.
Lord Business.
It's a very similar take, right? Like it's a very similar thing with a lot of similar kind of jokes. So it was the weak point of the movie for me as well. I understood why it was there, and I liked some of the jokes that to the expense of Mattel that result because of them being there. But but I agree that for the most part, it was unnecessary to make the point. And the reason it's also my negative is I think that it also takes away from what I think was the most underserved plot of the movie, which is the mother-daughter stuff. I thought that stuff was introduced well and then just kind of left hanging. And I kind of wanted their relationship to be more of a centerpiece to where we were going. But the movie wasn't about them, and the movie wasn't trying to be about them. The problem is the movie kind of heads in a direction that it seems like it's about them at first. But it's really about Barbie's relationship to them and what they're doing. So especially when it comes to the daughter character, that character has a very short character arc, and it happens very quickly and without a lot of understanding. So yeah, those were the weak parts for me. So I don't mind talking about those.
Something I've heard a lot, and when I do mean this a lot, and it's all come from women who I follow on social media, like YouTube, is I count as social media. they've all said that they found, especially the Gloria, which is the America Ferrera's character, the mom, mm-hmm. her big moment felt to them to be a little preachy. Now, me as a guy, I wasn't the target audience or the target one for that. I shouldn't say that I'm not the target message, because I think that's a universal message, what she's trying to say. I think that's something that she wants to say, not just to women, but to everybody. I didn't get that it was preachy, but I've heard not one, two, three, but more people say that they found this move to be preachy. Did you guys get any of that?
No,
because I didn't.
I didn't get it. It's so hard for me to see that stuff sometimes, because I'm made very aware that we all come with different backgrounds, different perspectives, different narratives, and different eyes, right? And yeah. It makes me very aware that many people just don't see the world the same way I do. And that is okay. It just makes me sad, because I think there's so much, like I said, there's so much empathy available. If you come out of this movie and go, quit preaching at me, I just think you're missing the opportunity to feel something on somebody else's behalf, right? Mm-hmm. And that's what makes that's what makes me sad. But it doesn't make me necessarily angry. Like I don't get upset that people find it preachy or too woke, whatever that means, or whatever the case may be. It just makes me sad that they're missing an opportunity to learn something, to grow, to evolve, to, you know, put themselves in a different mindset.
I can definitely say I did not think of it as preachy. Neither did anyone I've spoken to. Like, I went obviously with a big group and everything. We were talking about that scene, and everyone in my cinema cheered after that moment. Because it, again, that was one of the moments where you're just kind of sitting there going like, yes, like it's articulating.
So well said, and it's so, like, it feels true from the female experience.
And like, I also like how the way in which it enters the film, like, it doesn't feel like it was kind of shoved in there to be shoved in there. Like, it felt like America Ferrera's character is working through these thoughts, because of the way that this begins, the way that she's beginning this moment is by speaking to someone else, and then it's almost like she's just kind of, because of everything else that's happening, it's just kind of coming out of her very naturally. And so you're just sitting there being like, I almost wish, because I don't think this is spoilers, but it does cut to other reactions during it. I almost wish it had just been on her the entire time, because I was just sitting there going, I want that on my wall. Like, I want that quote. There's a few quotes actually in this movie where I was like, especially one towards the end about mothers, where me and my friends were like, oh.
The beautiful, beautiful pain.
It just made me want to call my mom and like, yeah, just hug her. And I actually do want to go see this with my mom, because I think it's important to see it as a mother and daughter. And I think the preachy might just be because, like, people who feel that, it might just be because they are uncomfortable with these things being given voice in such an overt way, when normally they're not. It's always subtext, and it's just being given a position as text. And so I can see that potentially being confronting for some people, and the confronting ends up being translated as preachy. But I personally think it was great.
Yeah, it's tough too, because one of the things I love about this movie is I actually think this movie is really nuanced. I actually feel like Greta is doing some really interesting things here about femininity and masculinity and not giving easy answers. I think you even mentioned this earlier, Alice. Like, I don't ever hear in this movie, here's the right way to do it, or here's what it means to be a woman. What I see is a lot of different things. Now, some of the things, like this movie, I think even at one point says something about, like, if you want to be a mom, be a mom. If you don't want to be a mom, don't be a mom. Like, that kind of thing. And so it gives even voice to this idea of, you know, well, what if I want that life? You know, what if it feels amazing to me to raise kids at home and that kind of thing. And The thing is, the movie isn't interested in digging deep into those things because those have been the norm for years. You know what mm-hmm. I mean? Like, so like, it's not interested in spending a lot of time there, but it is here. And I found the movie's ability to go, we're not sure of exactly the answer, but yep. we do know we need to listen to each other and we need to figure out who we are. Like, and that goes beyond gender. Which, by mm-hmm. the way, I love every moment this movie decides to go, you know what, maybe it's not even about gender. Because there's so much gender stuff in here, which I think is totally understandable. But that the movie itself is even willing to go, you know, maybe gender isn't really the issue here. Maybe it's humanity. Maybe it's just understanding, you know, like who we are as human beings. Yeah, I found it really nuanced. So that makes it extra difficult to hear, oh, it was preachy. Because I'm like, usually things that are preachy or pedantic have a very straightforward message they're trying to give you.
Yeah.
And the only message I heard in this movie was, it's good to be able to find out who you are and how you relate to your gender, to, you know, your ability to be who you want to be. That's what this movie says. And I did not take this movie to say men are terrible in the least. That did not feel like what this movie was saying. So, yeah. It's weird to me to hear that.
I see it almost as a reflection. I see this film as, it's like you said, it's not about solving any issues or solving any themes. I think it's about reflecting on who we are and individually and both as a species, but also in a way where it's like, why don't we just talk about it? Like, when we don't have to solve every issue, we don't have to get together to discuss and make patriarchy, you know, even or anything like that. It's just about, let's just talk about it. Let's open it up so that everyone, men, women, and, you know, everyone else alike can get together and discuss it and just share their experience. Yes. And I think that also comes from the fact that this was written both by Greta Gerwig and Noah Baumbach, who obviously, like, his work on Marriage Story, it was almost like a similar deconstruction, but of marriage rather. And now it's like a deconstruction of gender and society. Of
their relationship too. Like, that's the other part of them writing together, is like they're deconstructing their own stuff, you know? So
yeah, exactly. And so I can sense that there was, I would have loved to be a fly on the wall during those writing sessions because the conversations they must have had. I was talking to my friend. I'm like, you know, because they've just had a kid. And I'm like, that child is going to grow up so intelligent. But I think it's such an, it is, for me, this is a movie that's important for the discussions that it'll ignite from people that have seen it. Whether you liked it or not, I think it is still important to see, just to, so that you can then wrestle with what it makes you feel and then think about, why does it make you feel that way? And yeah, but all of that aside, you can also just really enjoy it because it's such a funny, fun, pretty movie. Like, that's what I also love, is that even if you're not interested, you don't always have to go in and think about it from the cerebral perspective. You can just sit there and watch it and be really entertained as well, and watch a shallow story if that's what you prefer. And so I think this is going to be an interesting movie to unpack over the next few decades, really.
I am in awe of Greta Gerwig. Lady Bird remains one of my favorite movies. Little Women is an incredible film. And I'm just astonished at what she's done here. Let's do some final things. What else do you want to say about this movie, Andrew?
No post-credit scene.
That is true. Although there is some fun credit stuff. Brings attention to some of the very real things that this movie had in them that you can't believe are real. Why would they do that? Good question. Good question.
You know who wants that? No one. No one wants that.
I love Emerald Fennell stepping in as Midge. He's
just like... Oh, I loved Will Ferrell's when he saw her and he's like,
a Midge.
Didn't we get rid of you? Oh, that's so good. I enjoy. See what I mean? That's just a funny moment. Like, I just thought
there's
that was
so
a fun
many.
Little,
yeah. Oh, you could literally, if somebody else has seen this movie, you will find yourself sitting with them and going, do you remember that one line when they said, do you remember that line? Like that. Alice, any final thoughts?
obviously, we all understand that I hated this film. No, I yeah. loved it. But there is a single joke in this film where I was like, ooh, that's going to date. I can sense that'll be dated. And I'll just, for your reference, I'll say it's a moment. I know the one you're talking about. Yeah, you know the one I'm talking about. Andrew, do you know the... I'm going to put it in the private chat. And then you guys can...
Oh, interesting.
Yep. That's the one I was thinking. Yeah, yep. You could be absolutely right about that. But boy, did it hit. That's the only thing. It hit right now, though.
It hit really well right now. I actually also think all the other jokes of that montage are fine. Those are timeless. They'll work. But this specific joke, I'll be interested to see, is it funny now or is it going to date in like 10 years? So that is the only one.
I felt attacked by this movie whenever they had The Godfather.
Yes.
I think we all saw ourselves in this movie and like we're able to grow a little bit and go, oh my goodness, I've done that.
At The Godfather, I literally turned to my friend. I'm like, oh, it's my friend. I like turned and could we talk? I was like, it's that, it's our friend because they have literally done that to us.
do you want me to talk through the movie for 3 hours and tell you all about how amazing it is?
But then, like I said, you feel equally attacked if you're a woman, specifically at a moment with Pride and Prejudice, where you're just like,
and again, the movie is pointing out things that it's able to laugh at. I don't think that's judgy. Like, I don't think it's... In fact, I had...
Oh, I say I felt attacked. I was, you know, being, you know,
right. flippant. I saw myself and was kind of a little bit embarrassed, right? Like, that's been me or whatever. Because that can be annoying, right? Like,
I think
that kind of behavior can be annoying, but what's interesting is the things he was saying weren't like dumb guy saying dumb things that don't make any sense. They were legitimately interesting film observations. That's a choice they made, right? Like that's when they were writing this, the choice to go, okay, it's not that the dude is being obtuse. It's just that he's misunderstanding the idea of, you know, mansplaining and how that can sound or feel or, you know, whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think it's just showing it's like they aren't doing this to show superiority. They're doing this because they genuinely want to share these thoughts. But it's the same. It's the exact same with the Pride and Prejudice thing where I'm like, it's not attacking me. I just was more, how is this enough of a universal experience that it relates? It's not just specifically relating to me, you know, and it wasn't just the Pride and Prejudice element. It was the entire preamble up to it where it's like, you know, you're scrolling and then blah, 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 and then you end up just doing that again. I'm just like, no, that's an Alice thing. That's not a millions of people watching this thing. Like, I literally did that
Greta
the other
and Noah
day.
I have cameras in your house. And
it's just, and that's what I mean. I think honestly, it's almost like how great comedians just observe things really well. I do just think it's great observation from Gerwig and Noah Baumbach's part. Like, but... it's just so interesting.
I always, you know, I kind of pay attention to the clock to kind of wind us up on reviews and, you know, because we could talk for a long time, but I may have cut us off too soon on this one. I have a lot more to say, I think, but it's one of those movies that continues to give. I know I have to say a couple things. Number one, there is a scene fairly early on in the movie where Barbie sits on the bench with somebody and in two sentences, it destroyed me. And everything this movie was about and everything this movie was trying to say was in this compact moment of two lines between two women, and I was just moved. And then after the screening, my friend said, did you know that the studio tried to make her take out that scene and she had to fight really hard to leave in that scene? And she told them, if you make me remove this scene, I don't know what my movie's about anymore. And because on its face, as an executive, you're right. The plot doesn't need that scene. The get from point A to point B doesn't need that scene, but it is the heart of the movie in just that one moment. And like the ability to fight for that, to understand that, and to deliver it so well. Like, I get choked up when I think about that scene. And I just think there's something really beautiful about it. And So I definitely wanted to mention that. And it's wild to me that two lines can just destroy me. Like two lines in a movie that I can remember 4 hours later and I'm destroyed again. Like, you know, it's just
two lines, four words total.
Yes, it is. It's four words.
For me, what it does, I will say, I think this movie has one of the best integrations of a song into a scene that I've seen in a long time, because the Billie Eilish song is, I've been listening to, I keep humming it. I'm just every day, I'm just humming it. And then when I've been listening to it and walking home or whatever, I play the scene in my head and then I start getting all emotional. I'm like walking down the street, walking home, and I'm just needing to get away tears because I picture that moment in my head. And I found out something about that moment where it's all, I'm not going to go into it. I'll tell you guys later, but basically it's a window into reality, and it just gives more to that moment, and it gives more just depth and beauty to it. And I think the song complements it so perfectly because it's such a cathartic moment that lets you sit in your emotion. And I don't think enough movies let you do that. Like, I feel like it's like, especially, you know, when something's a bit more zany and you have to wrap it up, and sure. I'm just like, it just lets you sit in it, and it's just one of my favorite things for a movie to do.
I won't go through and mention all the specific lines I thought were amazing, but some of them, one of them I want to mention because I think it encapsulates this idea that this movie is saying important things at the same time it's making you laugh. They've been in the real world for a second, and Ken is adjusting to the idea that the attention he's getting is positive, and he says, I feel like everybody's like paying attention to me, and there's not an undertone of violence at all. And Barbie's character says, that's so weird. I definitely feel that undertone of violence. And I'm just thinking, how dark is that? And yet how true is it? And how much empathy is available there for a man to go, oh, can you imagine any attention you get has this undertone to it? And like, I just think this movie is so good at making you think about things in a way that maybe you haven't thought about them before. And again, that's coming from my perspective as a man watching this. But so I really, really enjoyed that. The final thing I will say, this will be my one last thing, my part C of my one last thing. Funniest last line of a movie in 10 years.
I was about to say, what subversion.
Just died. It was amazing. So good stuff. Barbie, there you go. It is out now in theaters, if you can find a ticket.
Good luck.
All right, let's move on to Oppenheimer.
We imagine a future, and our imaginings horrify us. They won't fear it until they understand it. And they won't understand it until they've used it.
The story of J. Robert Oppenheimer's role in the development of the atomic bomb during World War II. That's all you're going to get, because that's really all you need. That is what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with Oppie. So this is Christopher Nolan's latest. So what did you guys think? Did you like it, love it, dislike it, hate it, or it was just okay? Andrew, kick us off.
Loved it.
Nice. Alice.
I'm also firmly in loved it.
Ooh, well, let's go with the triple loved it.
Oh, what a positive week.
Yeah, on a hot streak for me. I'm just loving movies these days. Perfect time for just them to stop making movies. And
exactly.
It's wonderful timing. Just really, really great timing. Andrew, since you hated Barbie, we'll let you start this one. Tell us what you loved about Oppenheimer.
Oh, man, this movie was made for me. Oppenheimer's one of my favorite historical figures. Like, I've read his I've read his biography. I've seen several documentaries on the guy. Believe it or not, I own a piece of Trinitite, which is the piece of material made from the Trinity explosion. I don't have it here in the house. It's at my parents' house because they were wanting to look at it. But yeah, I have a little piece of this green glassy material that was made from the gadget explosion. That's what the bomb's called. So going into this movie, it's kind of like how I felt whenever I went in to see The Dark Tower. And Aaron was there with me whenever I saw the Dark Tower movie, something that's so near and dear to my heart.
Very different outcomes.
It's a very different outcome as opposed to the Dark Tower, though, because I think that Christopher Nolan did a remarkable job with this. And I think that not only he did a great job, but also the cast did amazing. But my first pro for this movie is going to be the script, because I think that the script for this film is remarkable. I don't know if you guys know this or not. This is one of the first scripts ever written in first person, where Christopher Nolan wrote this from Oppenheimer's perspective. So all the stage direction in this movie in the script was, I moved over to the coffee table. I saw Kitty come in from the kitchen.
Oh, that's
so
interesting.
That was, so that's how Emily Blunt would know. Yeah, Emily Blunt would be like, okay, Kitty, I watched Kitty walk in from the kitchen. That's my cue to walk in from the kitchen. So that's how this film was written, which I thought was fascinating. But it lets you know if the title didn't. This is about Oppenheimer. It's not about the Manhattan Project. It's not about the H-bomb. It's not about Lewis. This movie is kind of about Lewis Strauss, but which I really want to talk about. But this movie is about Oppenheimer, and yeah, I absolutely loved it.
Alice, some thoughts?
Yeah, I think as well, this is another one that's interesting because of the American context versus the non-American context, which is where I'm coming from. And so I knew a little. I haven't read American Prometheus, although now I want to. And I knew about Oppenheimer, obviously, and can I just say really quick, it is shocking to me how little people know about Oppenheimer and the Manhattan Project and Hiroshima and Nagasaki, because my friend had two separate groups of people ask about, like, oh, did Germany get bombed? I didn't know Germany got bombed. And it's like, no, Japan got bombed. Like, it's just, I think this is a very important story just to refresh on what... Yeah, exactly, from education. But the thing I've been saying in terms of why I think this, why I also think Christopher Nolan is a genius. We just have a lot of geniuses this week.
Yeah, a couple geniuses making movies this week.
Yeah, but why I think he's a genius is the way he told the story, similar to Barbie in a way where it's not giving judgment on anything that's happened. It's not overtly being like, this is good, this is bad. It is Oppenheimer and telling his story. And what it's doing is it's showing these moments of his life and using the current historical and societal context that we are in right now, so that what's happening on screen is interpreted in a very different way based on where we are sitting with our current political sensibilities, our current historical sensibilities, and the way in which it interprets it. It really plays with the human mind and bias, and makes us, again, similar to Barbie, it's a reflection into, this is what we were, this is what happened. How do you feel about that right now? It's almost like this film gave me a psychoanalysis into, but how do you feel about it right now? How is this affecting you right now? Being presented with what happened in relation to how it affected, how this man's life affected his own and other people's. And I just think it is so important right now to tell a story like this, because it would be so easy to just make someone, like, to make him a villain because of the whole I am become death, destroyer of worlds, and you know, the project he led or anything like that. Or it'd be so easy to do on the other side and try and, like, either victimize him or anything. And instead it's like, no, this is just a person and this is what he did and this is the outcome of what he did and the ramifications that he felt. And then obviously that he ended up enduring. And then I also really enjoyed how it took us, it continued on past the Manhattan Project and, you know, into the next era of his life and shows all of those elements because I had no idea about any of it. And it reframes the entire story. And classic Nolan, you know, you get little moments of it at the beginning of the movie and you're just like, I don't really get it, but I'm sure I'll get it by the end. And then by the end, when you have the whole, I'll say the motivation reveal and you're just like, oh, yeah. And it just recontextualizes the whole story for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I will start there and bounce off of that to talk about how well this movie is structured. Now, that's not a surprise with Christopher Nolan. He's possibly the structure guru. Like that's his whole thing is figuring out how to structure things. But his ability to play within these two stories, basically, you know, he's telling the story of Oppenheimer, but he's always also telling the story of Strauss's trying to get on the cabinet approval. The way he interweaves them is so smart, and the way he uses them to inform each other is it's so subtle that you almost don't notice it. But if you start paying attention to the cuts, it's fascinating how cohesive the story he's telling is for how much he's jumping around. And I just thought that was genius level stuff. The way that this is structured and edited together is really, really smart. What else?
Yeah. Just so everybody knows, this movie was shot, I think, 98% in IMAX, which I did go see this in laser IMAX.
Is it worth seeing in IMAX?
I think that no, it's not worth seeing in IMAX. I would say like a lot of people would say, you know, like, ooh, you get to see the Manhattan Project on laser IMAX. It's, while that I would say is the climax of the film, I definitely wouldn't say it's the most important part of the film by any stretch of the imagination.
The only reason,
honestly. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say the only reason when it's something like this where, you know, it's shot in IMAX and it is in IMAX format for a lot of this movie, my thing isn't even just like, oh, is it more spectacular? My thing is often I feel like I'm missing parts of the intended frame, like, you know, how it was framed, how it was, you know, how it's meant to look. Like the top and the bottom's been chopped off for me. When I watched it, like I literally missed the top and the bottom of the screen. So
there's definitely some beautiful vignettes in this film that are like, oh man, just this landscape of Los Alamos is gorgeous.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Can we talk about the performances?
Sure. Let's go ahead. Let's get that out of the way.
Killian Murphy's performances
were terrible.
Worst part of the film. I think his command over the accent, the very specific Oppenheimer accent, given that he's an Irishman, I was just fascinated watching him. Having said that, I loved the moments between him and where him and Florence Pugh would like converse, because I think for me, I was like, put him in a room with like a cup of tea and just make
nothing
that the movie for
not
2 hours.
Close. Just them in a room with nothing else. Yeah. Don't even need their clothing.
But that's the thing. It's like, don't even need their clothing, but I don't even care because I'm just, these are two brilliant actors. Like, oh my goodness.
Yeah. I thought the nudity and the sex in this was actually handled very well and very interestingly too, as only Christopher Nolan could. But I didn't feel
it was the first time he's done nudity.
Yeah, it is. I didn't feel it was like gazy or any, like I just felt it was like an actual part in the stuff that happens during when they're cross-examining him or whatever, that little kind of part. I thought that was very interestingly presented in a way.
That's the standout part of the movie for me.
Yeah.
It really is. Yeah. Where there's a scene where Killian Murphy and Florence Pugh are in, I guess, compromising positions would be the best way to say it.
Yeah.
They're having sex. I mean, yeah. You know, yeah.
No, but I mean, like, during this cross-examination.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, and, like, it's just wild because to see these two people, you know, on display like this, it's such an invasive, you know.
Well, and it's what they're doing. Moment. The movie is saying this is what they're doing.
I know that's what I'm saying. I know it feels that way. I know that's the intent.
Yeah.
It's, yeah. But I'm just saying it's done. I would never have thought to do a scene like that to as a way to visually represent invasiveness in such a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think like
so smart.
What a great actress to, or what a great actor to cast in their role opposite Cillian Murphy for that, because I love Florence Pugh so much. I love her. She's so amazing. But then on the flip side of that, Emily Blunt is fantastic. She really, you know, she doesn't have obviously no one has as much to do as Cillian Murphy, but there is, she makes herself known. She makes her presence known. And there's a specific scene where she really kind of gets her moment to shine. And I was just like, oh, so that's the clip they'll play when she gets nominated for an Oscar, you know?
Yeah.
Like, oh, so good.
I mean, we haven't talked about Robert Downey Jr.
Yes,
but
my
like
hot take.
I don't know that it's that hot of a take. I literally think if only one person wins an Academy Award from this cast, it's him. Like I just think,
he's
that's the front runner from the cast. Yeah,
yeah. Everyone's kind of like, oh, it's his. It's like almost a it's his turn.
I
figured everybody would be saying that Cillian is the big takeaway performance from this movie. But honestly, I think Robert Downey Jr. he was chewing scenery like I've never seen him do before.
Well, that's interesting you put it that way. I wouldn't put it that way because it doesn't feel over the top to me. It feels almost understated to me. He's just really becoming somebody else. In fact, I went to see this with my wife and she said it was 30 to 40 minutes into the movie before I realized that was Iron Man. You know what I mean? Like it was, it's just,
I think he's using the charisma that he overblew like on purpose for Iron Man. And he's using it in a way where it shows you how people like this do rise ranks and do are able to get to these positions because they have this, you know, almost pheromone charisma that just attracts people, but it's not overt. They're not using it in the obvious peacocking way. They're using it to convince everyone that they're right, that their decision is the correct decision. And it just makes it so much more the vindictiveness he's able to show. And I just love it because if you watch him in, like, you know, Endgame where he's like the paragon of good, and then you watch this and then you watch Tropic Thunder and you're just like, oh, what an actor.
Yeah.
So eclectic.
Yeah, exactly. No, he's fantastic.
I kind of want to just start naming everybody who showed up for a cup of coffee in this movie. Because
Josh Hartnett was so good.
Because it's insane how many people just pop in and are like, hi, I'm a famous person here for a few lines. Like Gary Oldman pops in as Truman for a scene and blows me away. I'm like, how did you become Harry Truman?
Or Rami Malek? I kept being like, wait, that's
he's just there,
lead actor.
He's not even there to say anything. He's
best
just there
lead actor winner, Oscar winner Rami Malek. What are you doing
but
here?
But it's insane.
Hello.
Even once you get past the Oscar winners, like Gary Oldman and Rami Malek, you're coming with people that you just know, right? Like Jack Quaid. You know, stepping in.
Josh Peck.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Matt Damon, we haven't mentioned.
Dane DeHaan.
Well, Matt Damon's not showing up for a cup of coffee.
Well, that's true.
Which is funny.
Damon's a role. That's true.
Casey Affleck and Dane DeHaan. I was like, oh, I haven't seen you in a hot minute.
Casey Affleck is creepy. And so is his character.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Kenneth Branagh. It, you know, plays a medium role.
I love Kenneth Branagh so much.
His accent is so good in this movie.
Accented characters.
Oh, it's
like,
so good.
Look at you. Oh, and also like people like James D'Arcy, who plays the tutor at the beginning. And I was like, oh, yeah, I reckon that Christopher Nolan just has that kind of pull right now where it's like, hey, I've got a couple of lines.
Yeah, the Rolodex, man.
Do you want to come?
Jason Clarke. just stepping in for you to play that role. Like,
and Tony Goldwyn's in there as well. Mm-hmm, like,
it's like people want to work with Christopher Nolan and they'll take any role they can get.
You know what it is, I reckon? It's because if you watch Cillian Murphy's trajectory in the Nolan projects, they're kind of like, oh, you see, I start out small. There'll be two lines in Oppenheimer, but give it a few years and then I'll be Oppenheimer.
We haven't mentioned one of my favorite performances in the movie, again, because it's pretty subtle and understated, but it gets a big impact. And that's Alden Ehrenreich, who...
Yes.
I think he's really good in this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Man, I was just so enamored with Robert.
But there's a moment of shift in his character where I bought it. Like, I was like, oh, he's just realizing this. And then you know what I love? It's like he's the audience insert, right? In that scene. And so you're going on the journey with him and then you're feeling the same things he feels. Oh, gosh. Everyone just really was like, it might only be for a couple of scenes, but it's a Christopher Nolan film. It's
Matthew Modine.
Yeah.
Scott Grimes. Another one.
I kept being like, look, it's the bad guy from Stranger Things as this one character.
David Krumholz. Like, it just keeps going on and on. Benny Safdie. I don't think we mentioned
yet.
I hope that this movie does for Josh Hartnett what Inception did.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I hope this movie does for Josh Hartnett what Inception did for Joseph Gordon-Levitt, where reintroduces them to the world, because I've loved Josh Hartnett for so long.
He was like the main character, one of the main characters in the arguably best episode of the current Black Mirror season as well.
Yeah.
Josh Hartnett.
Yeah, he's in Beyond the Sea with Aaron Paul. Season yet. Well, the best episode is the one that him and Aaron Paul are in, which is Beyond the Sea. And he does very well. He does very, very well, which makes me think, having seen him now in this and Black Mirror, I'm like, oh, is he about to get a little Josh-a-sance, a Hartnessance or something, you know?
It is probably time soon to move on from this movie, but there's so many more things to talk about. So I'm going to throw a couple more out there. Mm-hmm. Sound design in this movie blew my mind.
And I can hear what they're saying.
And yes, the dialogue is understandable. There's a scene after the successful detonation of the Trinity Project in a gymnasium with stomping feet that may be the most interesting use of sound absence that I've heard in a long time. And the way the movie plays that as a direct parallel to what just the sound just did with the detonation testing is really interesting, because it's playing with this idea of his life is the bomb being set off in some ways. And so it both brings that anxiety of the character and also continues on with the, you know, the theme of the waves and how things hit us and those kind of things. So the sound design was amazing. This is a moral quandary movie, which I always love. This is the kind of movie you can walk away going from, you know, saying, what would I do? What would I be? Now, for me, that question's maybe a little more on the surface than most, just because I've embraced my pacifism. Like, it's very easy for me to go, no, I will not design your bomb. Because, like, I don't believe in the idea of assured, you know, mutual destruction, those kind of things. I think... you know, I've talked about that before, but there is that moral quandary of, well, you know, I think the line's even in the movie. I don't know if it's the right thing for us to make this bomb, but I know it's a wrong thing for us to let somebody else make this bomb. And I think that's a really interesting thing to think about. I guess the only other thing I would say is, before I talk about it a little bit, this will be my one last thing, and I'll let you guys finish this out. How did you feel about the fission-fusion separation of the storylines? Did that make sense to you? Did you understand how did you understand those two storylines to play together?
Wait, what? Fission fusion?
You know, it has like the chapters at the beginning.
Yeah, at the beginning it says one, you know, fission, two, fusion for
and
the
and it's separating the black and white and the color, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oppenheimer's from the
it's Strauss just one for Strauss's. Me it's one of those things where it's like when I first watching it I was like, I don't get it, but I'm sure I will when I get to the end because it's a Christopher Nolan film. It's just one of those things where I just, going into any Nolan film, I'm like, I'm not going to get it until we're 75% of the way through. And then when it clicks, I'll go back and rewatch it and be like, oh, and I think that's what it did for me.
So what's interesting to me, and I've been thinking about this a lot because I know Nolan's brain works this way. There's enough material out in the world to show us that Nolan likes puzzles, likes ideas, likes to do interesting things with his structure, those kind of things. And it's interesting because I haven't heard a lot of people talking about this. And most people are just seeing it as an introduction to these different stories. Like, well, we'll just call one Vision and one Fusion. Because Nolan didn't do that purposefully, like with a theme in mind. Like, can we think a little bit more about this?
Yeah.
The idea of fission versus fusion is very interesting. Fission is the idea that you can split an atom and what is small becomes big, right? Mm-hmm. That's the idea of fission. Fusion is actually the opposite. The opposite with fission happens. You split an atom and it implodes. And so what is big, you start with something big and it becomes small. And that's like so much more powerful than fission is. And as you watch these two stories, I couldn't help but think of how that related to what they were going through. The big things that become small and the small things that ricochet out and become big. And they talk often about how the whole idea is this chain reaction, right? And you even think about it in the central bookends of what we're looking at. I'll just call it the pond scene with a very famous physicist who I thought was really interesting to have it in this this movie.
I always forget that he was alive then. Like, I always just think he was like 300 years ago or something. And I'm like, oh, yeah.
Well, yeah. I remember during World War II, he wrote Roosevelt those letters. And that was always... Here in America, that was always in our history test lessons.
I mean, it is in the trailer. I think we can just say who it is, but...
Oh, is it? Okay, that's fine. Yeah. Einstein is in this movie.
Einstein.
And so he has a conversation with Einstein by the...
For several
by
scenes.
The pond. Well, it bookends the movie in some ways, and I think it's very, very purposeful. Because
Okay, I will say again, before you continue, similar to how you ended the last movie, I love the final line of this movie as well.
Me too.
Yeah. That's the line he says to Einstein, right?
Yeah.
So the idea here is that that line is both fission and fusion because it connects the two stories. That is where is the connecting point between these two stories, because it launches this pettiness in Strauss, right? Because he interprets it in a certain way. And it is the result, the end result of Oppenheimer's feelings about what he's done, the big. So the big has become, this big explosion has become small to, you know, in Oppenheimer, and very intimate and very real. And in that moment, he sets off a chain reaction. He literally sends Albert Einstein as a molecule off of his bomb that he just set and has a chain reaction that starts the other part of the movie in the fusion process. And I just find all that stuff. And look, I don't know how much of that is intentional, how much of it I'm saying correctly, how much of it, you know, Nolan would believe. But when you're dealing with a filmmaker like Nolan, you have to know that kind of stuff is in there somewhere and is going on.
It's percolating somewhere.
Yeah. And I really believe this movie does a lot with those ideas of chain reactions and how things impact other things and how big things become small and how small things become big and how both of those explosions can change lives.
And I think it also just shows where it's like, you know, like I said, it's easy for history to have villainized Oppenheimer as like, oh, he created the atomic bomb and killed all these people. But it's like this exploration, I want to say, like, this is how you do a character study, you know? And this exploration of he was just a scientist and he was theorizing and he's just a human who had all these ideas. Yeah, he was a jerk, but he was just a as most scientific geniuses are. But also, like, he just wanted to explore theory, you know? And then, of course, it you know, he didn't go, oh, this theory, make it a bomb, you know? It was a collection of other people who then chose to take it and you know, create this project, and the rest is literally history. But it just kind of shows, to use your, you know, your exploration, Aaron, around the fission and fusion, but it's like he just had these ideas and then someone thought, we should harness that idea and use it to our advantage. percentage, mm-hmm. and that's how you end up with an atomic bomb.
Yep.
And then, but it also is planting throughout the whole movie the exploration of the hydrogen bomb as well, which is even worse, you know, in terms of like the outcome and so, or like potential outcome. And so it's just so interesting to show how it's like, he didn't just wake up one day and go, I'm going to build a bomb. You know, it's all just small decisions and small choices that lead to these effects.
I heard somebody say that they felt like the movie valorized him too much. And I just was like, what movie were you watching? Because I really feel just like it showed him. It showed him trying to poison his teacher. Like, he is not he's not like a top notch guy at the end of the day. It showed him making light of his affairs. You know, like, mm-hmm. you know, there's a very key moment later on where he admits to an affair in a very passive and, you know, callous way.
It's offhandedness.
Yeah. So, like, I don't think the movie is trying to make him look like a good guy.
I think anyone in this movie is a good guy. Like, I think that's kind of the point, is that including his wife, like, including Emily Blunt, you know, everyone in it is just someone who made it. Honestly, everyone in it is just a human being, mm-hmm. and it's not good or bad. And I, the other part toward the end, that I loved is there's this conversation that he has with his wife, and you know, and she's asking him like about fighting and stuff, and he and she asks him a question, and he's like, maybe we'll see. And I was like, oh my god, like, it's just it's so intense of a react, and then but the way he says it is so passive, and you're just like, this person is in turmoil constantly, mm-hmm. and doesn't care. Like,
in the movie, I think the movie has the strength to allow him to have agency over those terrible actions, and that's something I've missed in biopics, because many recent biopics have stolen the agency from their central characters and made any bad choices they made the fault of somebody else. And and I think this movie is more nuanced than that. It's also doing a lot different things and a lot bigger things than those movies are usually doing, but but yeah, it's really, really interesting. You guys' final thoughts,
Andrew?
No post credit scene. And no. I'm surprised that out of the two movies this week, both of them are just existentialism the movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I will say people have been like, oh, you should go see Oppenheimer first because then you'll all be depressed and get all happy as a result of seeing Barbie. No, you will walk out with an existential crisis no matter the order you go in. So you might as well just let it happen. Just let it happen. Yeah. Go home. Your life.
There's a little more hope at the end of Barbie than there is in Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah, a little bit, but you're still questioning your reality. So my one last thing is just from the layman's perspective. By that I mean people unlike us that watch and care about movies as much as we do, because I went to go see this with my partner, who is, not to call him a layman, but you know, a regular person who only goes to see movies when I take him to the movie theater with me. This movie could be seen as a little long. It could, like, 20, 30 minutes too long for someone who, A, is not a big historical, like, nerd, or B, isn't as used to being as enveloped in a film for that long. And so I think that is just something to keep in mind. I still think it's important to go see, but just keep in mind it is a 3-hour movie. Like, yeah, that's my last one.
There you go. And that is Oppenheimer. All right, before we head on to the best ever challenge, big thank you to our SifPop members. Thank you for supporting what goes on here at SifPop. You can do that at Patreon, patreon.com/SifPop. We recorded a fun pre-show for our SifPop members with some interesting discussions on streaming and some other things, as well as another drunk SifPop and a SifQuest and all sorts of fun stuff. Andrew's leading those now. So if you want to check those out, become a SifPop member at Patreon, patreon.com/SifPop. And thank you for doing so. All right, best ever challenge, fake first, legit last. Movies that have a fake first name or a fake character's first name as the title, or a legitimate person's last name as the title. We will go number 5 to number 1. And of course, if you have it higher, make sure you let me know so that we can... Trumpets. All right. Alice, why don't you kick us off? What is your number five best ever fake first, legit last?
Well, I gotta say, I am very happy because it made me, I was struggling between choosing between my buried treasures. And because of this, I didn't have to. Oh, because nice. Now I can say one of them, which is Nimona. A very recent film on Netflix, which is amazing, based on a graphic novel, which is also amazing. But the Netflix film actually takes what's in the graphic, because I've read it, takes what's in the graphic novel and really explores the themes and takes it to that next level. And I love this film. It's so great. If you haven't seen it, it's only like an hour and 40 minutes. Fantastic animation in a unique way. It's not, you know, it's not the Spider-Verse animation. It's not Disney animation. It's like a new version, almost like a graphic rather than comic. It's almost like a graphic novel-y animation. Great exploration into fantasy. For those of you who don't know, it's basically about this guy who ends up being a villain, and he gets a sidekick, Nimona, who's a shape-shifting minion / sidekick, and they have to get together to try and take down the institution of heroes, who may or may not be what it seems. But it's very, very good. Highly recommend.
Nimona's so good.
I've seen it.
It's a great
choice. I've seen it pop up every single time I come up on Netflix, and it's in my queue. So now that I have two people have actually confirmed that it's good.
You should definitely watch it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's really good. Like, really, really good. I'll go next. My number five is Rango. I really like this movie, Johnny Depp lizard movie. I think it's really funny, very interestingly shot. Lot of artistry to this movie and a lot of fun. It's what makes it fascinating is it's a Gore Verbinski movie, you know, so it's not kind of your typical director for this kind of fare, but it's good stuff. If you haven't seen it, check it out. I really enjoy Rango. That is nice. My number five. Andrew, what is your number five?
Logan.
Hit it, Aaron.
Trump!
All right, we'll wait on that one. Your number four, Alice. Right.
My number four is Juno.
Another good choice.
Nice.
Yeah, so I when I was doing this, I realized not to spoil anything coming up, all my honorable mentions, but there's a lot of Disney and you know, those sort of like superhero type movies. So I wanted something not of that ilk. And then Juno popped up and I was like, oh, that's such a good movie. I just love it. You know, Elliot Page is so fantastic in the role, and it's such a great little story. Michael Cera is also really good, and it's, you know what it is? It's also a movie that really changes as you age. So when I first watched this, when it came out, I was, you know, like 12, 13. And I remember interpreting it, especially the, you know, the bits with Jason Bateman, very differently. Because now I, you know, when I first watched it, I was more around Juno's mindset. And now I'm more around like an adult mindset. And it is very different, but it's still very good. Still very good.
Yeah. Good call. Juno. All right, I'll go on to my number four. This is where I have Trumbo at number four.
Oh, I forgot about that movie.
Very, very good. Bryan Cranston, in one of his best performances, about this very real character and how they dealt with McCarthyism and being blacklisted and still trying to get scripts done while in the bathtub. Lots and lots of interesting stuff in this movie. So you're going to want to check it out. Trumbo is my number four. Andrew, what is your number four?
Yeah, Bryan Cranston got an Oscar nom for that one, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think so.
Pretty sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's good new movie. My number four is also probably going to get trumped, so get ready. Aladdin.
Nope.
No.
Oh, no mentions for me.
Interesting. Okay. I didn't consider Aladdin in this category.
It's is that fake first.
Is it his first name? I thought he was like Steve Aladdin. I thought that his last name was.
No, I think it's like a share sort of thing.
Yeah.
No, okay. It's Aladdin. Okay. Yeah, it's his first name.
Cool.
Definitely his first name. It's not like he's not like, oh, maybe you got confused because in the movie he the prince version is called Ali Ababwa.
Yeah.
But that's not his actual name. His actual name's Aladdin.
That's the fake name. Yeah. Okay. Continue on.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. For the genie alone, you know, you have to put this on the list. Mm-hmm. It's one of the, if not the most amazing characters ever created for the screen. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Robin Williams, mm-hmm. he made it his, it's his movie. Pretty yeah. much.
Mm-hmm. Good stuff. Good stuff.
Too good.
Alice, what is your number three?
This is where I have Logan. So, nice. It's just, look, I really hope Deadpool 3 is good, because if Hugh Jackman ended his run on this crazy amazing movie, you know, with also like Daphne Keene, who, if you haven't seen the Golden Compass TV show or his Dark Materials TV show, she's very, very good in it. But it is just a great, sad exploration into what it means to be a superhero, but in this really depressing, realistic, gritty way with, you know, an aging Patrick Stewart and, you know, a very depressed Logan, and it's so good. I need to watch it again. I haven't seen it in such a long time, but it's so good. Very good. Let's hope it's not marred by the next one.
Let's hope. Nah. Let's hope. All right. So I think that means my number three is where mm-hmm. we're yep. at. Amelie is what I have here at number three.
Ooh, good. Or Amelie. Pick.
It is a great movie.
List of shame.
Full of fascination, full of imagination. Alice.
And gnomes.
Alice, it really surprises me you haven't seen this movie. I think you would love this movie.
I know I would. It's exactly up my wheelhouse. It missed me because I was a stupid kid that was like, it's French. And now I have to go back and
watch
it.
I don't want to read.
Yeah, exactly.
Check it out. It is fabulous. And it is my number three. Andrew, what is your number three?
This is not going to get trumped by anybody, I'll tell you that right now. Going all the way back to 1954. Godzilla.
Nah.
It's in my top 100 movies of all time. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Want to talk about my favorite
That character, Godzilla
movie,
Jones.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like that's a creature name, not like a first name. I could be wrong.
You didn't
it's
say
Mr.
human
Godzilla in- to you.
Yeah, you didn't say anywhere in the email that they had to be human.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
And I certainly hope that holds for my next one too.
Oh yeah, because I have Jaws. Several on.
No, to be fair, his name's Bruce.
That's true.
So
he
that
has
would
his name
wrong.
Is Bruce.
That is true.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
But no, Godzilla is my favorite movie about the atomic age mm-hmm. and like. Mm-hmm. How for a lot of people who don't know this, Japan's culture was very, very stringent after the war. Like America's mm-hmm. hold on Japan, especially their their cinema, they weren't allowed to make movies about nuclear catastrophes or anything like that. Their workaround was to make a giant monster movie mm-hmm. and have him be the have him be the metaphor for nuclear devastation mm-hmm. and here we are almost 100 years we're getting up there
yeah
know, 70 80 wow. years later
yeah
yeah
yep
and it's still relevant.
Still talking about it
yes they should make a movie about it. Alice, what is your number two?
My number two is Paddington.
It's my first honorable mention.
Yeah.
Because it is his first name, because his name is Paddington Bear. So
okay, fair enough.
And then he also takes the last name of the family, whose name I can't remember fully. But yes, Paddington is wholesome. I would have done Paddington 2, but that didn't count.
That
but
count,
the Paddington yeah. series, it's the first one's still very good.
It is good.
Opened the world to it. It's so just pretty and heartwarming and everything you need to be a palate cleanser to the two movies we saw this week. Just to make you be like, oh, just enjoy some niceness. It's just nice.
Nice.
Good. You should watch it.
All right. My number two is Lincoln. Comes in.
Honorable mention for me.
Number two. I love this movie. I think Spielberg's amazing and I think he directs this really well. And again, we've said it many, many times, but his most impressive feat in this movie was the you know, inventing an actual time machine to go get Lincoln and bring him back to star in the movie.
Yeah.
That's really yeah. impressive stuff. So,
yeah. And he's been so, you know, with that technology, he's taken care of it. You know, he hasn't let it fall into
nobody else
or anything.
It's been great.
Yeah.
Good for him.
Yeah.
All right, Andrew, what is your number two?
Wally.
Honorable mentions.
Love Wally.
I think that's first Wally. And last name. I think Wall is the first name.
Wall is his first name.
He is
Mr.
last name.
Wall.
I don't know how robot names work, you know.
There's a hyphen. I feel like the hyphen means it's all Wall
Esquire is what it stands for. He's a lawyer.
Yes.
Junior.
Yeah. But no, I love Wally to death. I want to see what the script for this movie looks like. It's just got to be fascinating and short and small.
Mm.
It's every single time I drive, there's a, what's the name of that sofa company that makes like recliners and stuff?
Lazy Boy?
Lazy Boy. There's a Lazy Boy store right next to where I live. And every single time I drive by, I just look in and I was like, one of these days I'm going to see one of those hover Lazy Boys from Wall-E.
You'll be like, it's going to
be in the showroom.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's like, it's happening.
It's going to happen.
Yep.
Oh, all right, let's move on to our number ones. Alice, what do you got?
My number one is Mulan, the original, not the atrocity that came out in 2020.
Oh, it's not that bad.
I didn't like it at all because this is perfect.
No, it's not. It's not that great either.
Because the animation is perfection. I think it has some of the best music. I just thought of another one. Okay, I'm going to write down my honorable mentions. But yes, no, it has the best music. This Mulan story is amazing because it is just about someone who has the will and builds herself up to this legendary status. And Mushu is fantastic. And the cricket is fantastic. And the Huns are terrifying. They're such scary villains. Mm-hmm. Like, such good character building for any child watching it. It's good. Very good.
Yep.
Let's get down to business.
Yeah, my number, some Donny Osmond.
My number one is my choice from the Pixar universe for this list, and that is Ratatouille is my number one.
Okay, that's... Does that count? That's not his name.
Sure it is.
No, it's not. It's Remy.
It's Remy. I hate that movie, and I even know it's Remy.
I mean, Andrew, you're so wrong, because if I was like, I wanted that to be my number one, but I was like, Ratatouille isn't his name.
Oh, okay.
No, his name's Remy.
I guess nicknames don't count then.
But is it his nickname?
Well, is it not? Fake first, real last. Where's the fake?
All right. Well, then I'll go with Wally as well. Will be my number one.
All right.
Yeah, I really enjoy that movie too. Andrew, what's your number one?
Rocky. Rocky is my number one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I've talked about this movie so many times because I always find a way to put it on my list. Haven't seen Rocky,
list of shame.
I think that you would really like it because I think that the biggest misconception with the Rocky movies is people think they're boxing movies and they're not boxing movies. Like, I think there's a grand total of 7 minutes worth of boxing in the entire movie. It's a love story. It's all about the love that blossoms between Rocky and Adrian.
I'll let you count Rocky if you'll let me count Ratatouille.
Why? His name is Rocky.
His name's Robert.
Where?
His name is Robert Balboa.
No. Yeah, that's Where true. You, that is true.
Isn't that his son's born. Name is
Is that what you're looking up, Aaron?
No, no, I'm not that petty.
All right, Strauss. Okay.
Well, fine. Wally is now my number one, and I'll just move up.
Looks like I'm the only one that followed the rules.
That's
folks.
Right. Alice wins today.
Well, I legit thought his first name was Rocky. So
yeah, it's a nickname.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, then fair play. Move Coco up to my number five, and then just
choice.
Everything.
So many good Pixar ones. Good choice. Other honorable mentions. Alice, why don't you list some for us?
Are you sure? Because I've got like 18.
Okay,
do you want to go first?
I have less than that, I think. Andrew, yeah. How many do you have that you want to throw out?
Well, I don't have any honorable mentions, but I do have what the gurus chose.
Oh, yeah. What did the gurus choose?
Believe it or not, there was a three-way tie for first place this week.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And they counted Rocky. So I'll just throw that out there.
Well, good for them.
So
they're Coco, also wrong.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Coco and Aladdin.
Nice. Mm. Nice.
Mm. Nice.
I'll throw
and
out
Mulan,
some.
Mulan was the runner-up. And since we're not counting Rocky, then Mulan gets third place.
Okay. Very nice. Very good. Patton, I think, is probably worth mentioning. Milk.
Oh, man.
Is a good movie. Mm. Capote.
That was on my list.
Also a good movie. Chaplin, also a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
Tesla, the new Tesla movie, is good.
I haven't seen the new Tesla
There's
movie.
There's a Tesla movie?
Mm-hmm. It's just called Tesla. Came out a couple years, last year or 2 years ago.
I have not heard of this.
Tom Hiddleston, or not Tom Hiddleston. What's his name?
Ethan Hawke?
Hitchcock, about the life of
Ethan
Hitchcock.
Ethan Hawke, that's the one.
It's good.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Hitchcock, that is a good movie.
Hannibal. Is worth mentioning, I think, as well. Hannah.
That was on my list.
Is a good one. Ali, Will Smith's Ali, I think, is worth mentioning. Frankenweenie, I think, is a really fun movie.
Oh, yeah.
Carrie, I think you have to mention Carrie.
Yep. I watched that for the first time last week, and I had a heart attack that I'm still not fully over due to the ending.
Uh-huh.
So,
yes. Which version did you watch? Yeah. The new one or the original one?
Why would I watch the new one?
How dare you, Andrew? How dare you insinuate?
I watched the original Sissy Spacek. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Annabelle, probably worth mentioning. Lucy, the Scarlett Johansson is a computer movie.
Is it worth mentioning?
I liked it. I know I'm in the minority on that, but I liked it. Alfred Hitchcock, speaking of Hitchcock, he had a movie called Marnie. That's pretty good, worth watching. And then Carol is another recent one that is worth watching as well. Did I knock some of yours out? Do you have a few more?
You did knock, but I've still got like 15. All right. There's one also, which is definitely my version of your Rocky and Ratatouille, so I'm gonna leave that to last. But I've got like Moana, Bambi, Cruella, all excellent. A lot of Disney. Maleficent also is a really great movie. I've got Tully. That was, I remember being really affected by that film. I remember walking away being like, oh. Yeah. This one, I didn't know if it would count. Hamilton, because it's like, it's on Disney Plus, but I didn't know if it would count as a movie.
Absolutely, I would count that as a movie.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, any chance you get to say Hamilton will count it.
Yes.
Okay. Right. Good. Well, now, the other one is Klaus, the Netflix film. Very good as well. Shrek. Can't not mention Shrek. Cinderella. Mm. Both of them, honestly. Kimmy, the movie, the Steven Soderbergh film. Movie.
Yeah. That's a good one.
Very excellent. I watched that on the plane, and I was, I actually think that was a good way to watch it, to be perfectly honest, given the claustrophobia of it all. Both Emmas, both the 1996 one with Gwyneth Paltrow and the more recent one with Anya Taylor-Joy, both are very good. And then the one I thought about before when I was saying Mulan is Hercules, because I love that movie. The music is so good. Nice. Then the one that I thought would definitely potentially get vetoed was Deadpool, because it's like, technically it's Wade Wilson, but also when he's Deadpool, he's Deadpool. He's not Wade Wilson. Mm. You know what I mean? It's one of those like weird meta things, but I just wanted to put it out there. Yeah. But those are mine.
Yeah. I do want to make it clear. It is the official stance of this podcast that you can indeed not mention Shrek. That is allowed on this podcast.
Yeah, Aaron's alone on that one.
Well, Shrek is great. It defined my generation, okay?
One of the most successful animated franchises of all time.
Hey, it won the Oscar for Best Animation Feature, so...
And now you understand. Now you understand where all the animosity comes from. All right, let's move on to the buried treasures for this week. Andrew, kick us off. What's that one thing in any area of pop culture that you want to make sure people know about?
In honor of Oppenheimer and all the atomic stuff that we have been talking about, I have a documentary for everybody called Atomic Soldiers. It's by The Atlantic. You can watch it on YouTube. There's several documentaries. in this series about this subject matter. So a lot of people don't know this. In the 1950s and 60s, three governments of countries, United States, Great Britain, and Russia, all started doing testings on hydrogen bombs, which is something that they talk about here in this film, Oppenheimer. But what was just declassified within the past 20 years from the U.S. and from Great Britain was that during these testings, they actually had soldiers on site who were exposed to the radiation and who actually got to see like what hydrogen bombs look like. So you have these documentaries. The one that is getting the most views is from The Atlantic on YouTube, and it's all the soldiers who were on site and how seeing the bomb like affected them, how they all had PTSD just because it's something so massive and mm-hmm. huge, like it's all encompassing. So it's actually these series of documentaries are actually what got me interested in Oppenheimer in the first place. So I figured it'd be a nice little tie-in. It is very depressing. Obviously, it's about veterans and all the health troubles that they have right now. The only country of the three that hasn't declassified anything is Russia. They won't talk about how many people have died, but they're estimating now that more people have died from the exposure to these H-bomb testings than people who died in Hiroshima and Nagasaki now. So it's wild that that people had to go through that.
Yeah. All right, so that's Atomic Soldiers on YouTube. I'll go next. My buried treasure, for most people, it was Barbenheimer weekend. For my family, it was Barb Pickheimer weekend. That is because this weekend, Pikmin 4 came out on the Nintendo Switch, and we are a Pikmin family. I loved the first three Pikmin games, and my wife, if it's possible, loved them even more than I did. She is a Pikmin addict, and we are seeking help. but the new game came out this weekend, and I've played a little bit of it, enough to recommend it. It's not my favorite Pikmin game so far, and it takes a little bit to get to the Pikmining, which is the one thing. If I could tell Nintendo, is like, you know, why does it take so long in this game to actually play Pikmin? Like, because they're trying to set up some new stuff and some new mechanics that are fun and interesting and work just fine. But it does take a while to get to the actual Pikmin of it all. So yeah, Pikmin 4, it also does an interesting thing. It retcons the first video game, which I don't know if I've ever seen this in this way specifically before, but it does a very interesting retcon of Pikmin 1. If you're a true Pikmin fan, you will notice it for sure.
I've never even heard of the game before, so.
You've never heard of Pikmin?
I don't have a Nintendo, so.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, it's like one of the main flagship games of Nintendo.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I think it should be, but Nintendo has always kind of treated it as a secondary kind of world. Even just the fact that it wasn't until Pikmin 4 was coming out that they even released Pikmin 1 and 2 on the Switch. Like, that just happened within the last couple of months. So yeah, Pikmin 3 was available on the Switch from the beginning, but 1 and 2 haven't been available until very recently. I would highly those games hold up really, really well. Pikmin 1 is a ton of fun, and it's a nice simple play. So yeah, I definitely will throw those on as multiple recommends just for all the Pikmin games. But yeah, Pikmin 4 is out on the Switch. Nice. Alice, what is your buried treasure?
So, my buried treasure is something that I think has been grossly misunderstood by critics, no offense to those in the room.
Hey, you're one too.
But I also think it's because, well, yes, no offense to myself as well. But I also think it's because I think the people that made the show, because I'm about to recommend a show, made a choice that I think was incorrect. And because of my prior knowledge, it didn't affect my enjoyment of it. and it made it better, which means I am going to be spoiling a little element of it, but it's only because I genuinely think knowing this element makes it better. If you don't know it, you will feel ripped off. So the show I'm recommending is The Crowded Room on Apple TV Plus. Those who know me and have known me for a while know that, especially during university, I fell into a DID, dissociative identity disorder, hole and became obsessed just learning all about it because it was just something, it fascinated me. And one of the most famous cases is Billy Milligan, who was the first person to use it as a defense in court in the 70s. And when I found out that they were making a show about based on Billy Milligan, but obviously loosely based in its own story, I was very excited. And this show is The Crowded Room. So it's, you know, it's not an exact telling of Billy Milligan. It's a different character called Danny Sullivan, but it is exactly the same.
Oh, inspired by sort of thing.
Yeah, inspired by sort of thing. But it is literally like, if you know the story, it's very strongly pulled. But what they've done is they've done the like... the movie's like 30 years old, but it's done the thing where it doesn't reveal the dissociative identity disorder thing until episode like 5. And I think that was the wrong choice because I knew from the moment it started that it was a story about dissociative identity disorder. So you're knowing that you're able to pick things up immediately and see, oh, okay, this is what this means. This is what this means. And it makes it more interesting and it allows you to focus in on the story more. I think because of that, it has been relatively panned critically because especially critics, they only watch the first few episodes and it takes a bit. I also think this is a show that maybe you should binge. Like, I don't know if this is a week by week sort of show. Having said all of that, now, especially as we're in the last couple of weeks of it, I think Tom Holland is giving an extraordinary performance. It is absolutely amazing the way he's been able to stretch completely away from the Spider-Man aesthetic we've seen him in, but not in like the bad cherry way, like in a really interesting way. I think Amanda Seyfried is also in it and she is absolutely amazing. She plays a psychologist who develops a relation, like a psychologist and patient relationship and kind of develops the theory behind the character Danny Sullivan. And the 70s aesthetic is also really great. And I just think I really am enjoying it. I'm enjoying the way in which it's also framing all of the just the stigma behind this mental illness, because during this time it didn't exist in the DID, the way that they would diagnose mental illness. And that is to say, I think part of the reason some people have also been a little bit hesitant is because people often, it's very easy, and in Hollywood they've done it before, where it's like, oh, the bad guy has multiple personality disorder, which is what it was called before DID, and people that have DID can feel like, oh, you know, just because we have it doesn't mean we're violent. But because this is based on a very real case where this is what happened, it is just kind of showing that particular instance. And I think it's a very individual story, but it was happening at a time where this mental illness wasn't even believed. And so it was also showing how the world, or like it's kind of showing how the world got to know it and how it all kind of emerged in psychology, but also dealing with this very personal story of this boy whose life has been completely destroyed his entire life and he hasn't even known it until very recently. And so I think it's a really great show. I think it's a fascinating exploration into mental illness. And I really genuinely think Tom Holland is doing amazing work. So I think people should give it a chance.
There you go. That is The Crowded Room on Apple TV Plus. Pikmin 4 is available on the Nintendo Switch and Atomic Soldiers is on YouTube. Well, we did it, guys. We managed to do a podcast. Woo. Congratulations.
Yeah, we did.
To everybody, we accomplished a goal and didn't put millions of lives at risk. So congratulations to us.
That we know
we
of.
We don't know. Yeah.
Thank you so much
Alice
for joining.
Alice and I are glass half empty people.
Yes, I can see that. Thank you so much for joining us today. For Sif Pop, it is part of the Studio DNA Podcast Network. You can find out more about other shows on the network at studiodna.media or by searching Studio DNA in your podcast player. Huge thanks to Andrew for hanging out again today.
Thanks, buddy.
Big thanks to producer Phil for producing the audio and video show.
Thanks, Phil.
Big thanks to Alice for hanging out with us today. Ooh. Alice, merci. Where do you want to send people?
Well, like always, I am a sifpop.com writer, so actually my next review is going to be for The Crowded Room, so I don't know. We've still got two episodes. It could all just go awful, so we'll see. You never know. You never know. But I will be writing that up soon, as well as my next one-stop pop in the next couple of weeks. And then otherwise, you can also find me on Instagram and Letterboxd at LEGMICH. So I'll see you there.
Well, we always appreciate you being here, so thank you for coming by. Much love and gratitude to our SifPop members as well for giving to make SifPop a real thing. Support starts at $3 a month, and you get access to bonus episodes at some level, some other fun perks, so you can check all that out there. That's patreon.com/SifPop. Lots of ways you can connect with us. You can leave a comment, a rating, or a review at Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you listen. You can also email us, feedback@SifPop.com. And finally, if you're having a good time, your movie-loving friends will probably like this show too, so make sure you let them know about it and that listening is much easier than balancing the techno-ethical ramifications of pushing forward science at the cost of humanity. Or just being a woman. We'll be back next week with Haunted Mansion and possibly They Cloned Tyrone. So those will probably be the reviews next week, and we will see you then. Bye.
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 Want to get smarter about investing? Then tune into the Capital Ideas podcast from Capital Group, home of American Funds Distributors, Inc., one of the world's leading asset managers. Learn from portfolio managers with decades of experience by listening to the Capital Ideas podcast today.